Thank you, Phil. All right. Got it. Thanks, Phil. I'm John and I'm an alcoholic. And it's so great to be here. You know, wow, how amazing. I was thinking how nice it would be to, I'm a musician. And I was thinking how nice it would be to be playing in Tennessee tonight, but that's not to be. But this is absolutely the next best thing. To be speaking at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I just checked my clock and, I've got time. This is my 28th year. So my last sober birthday in November was 27. So what you're going to hear is what's, you know, that's that the view from 27 years. So let's start at the beginning. I was born in, 1960. I was born on this. How do you guys reverse it? 6/20/60 is my birthday. And I was born in the Midlands of England. I always loved that birthday, by the way. That was one thing I never wanted to change about myself. One of the few things was my birthday. I always loved the symmetry of that. I'm an only child. I was born to two really lovely, lovely people that were definitely not perfect, but they were good-hearted people, and I was their only child. I actually think I may have been the result of the only time that they had sex, as a matter of fact. But I'm not. I can't confirm that. But I just like, given what I saw, you know, later on, I thought, you know what, these guys, they just did it the once. You know, my father was he'd been a POW. He'd been a prisoner of war during the Second World War, and that was really the most, you know, that was the thing that went with him everywhere. It was the, I called it the khaki elephant in the living room. It was this thing that was just always there, ever present, the experience that he'd had, but I wasn't allowed to talk to him about it and blah de blah de blah. My dad, I think, was a very thirsty man, as it happened, and he was repressing his desire to drink all the time. And you know, my mom really didn't like him drinking. My mother was a Catholic. She was like a Catholic first and foremost. She was like a Catholic first, a human being second, you know, and she found through the church that was where she had her friends, that everybody there spoke her language. And, you know, she was a sweet, sweet gal. But you know, she married my dad. They moved out to the sticks. She didn't drive and she was kind of stranded. And so she was kind of lonely, you know, and she was lonely as she had me. And so, you know, we had a very close relationship. You know, as I was a little kid before I went to school, you know, every day the two of us would walk for miles to go to the church, you know, and we'd do that thing. My mom didn't like my dad drinking at all. I mean, you know, my first vision of alcohol was, you know, we had a drinks cabinet, you know, in the front room, you know, the best room. That was the room that we really only went into, you know, for like a special meal on a Sunday and like holidays, like Christmas. Like otherwise that room was locked tight, you know, had all the heirlooms in it, you know, not the, you know, whatever passed for an heirloom, but it had this drinks cabinet, and I would open this drinks cabinet, you know, even when I was a little toddler, and I'd see these kind of these green bottles, you know, Cinzano Rosso, Martini, Gordon's Gin, you know, Bell's Whiskey, all these brand names, and these smell and sticky tops and all this and this stuff, you know, and it was kind of mystical, you know, in a way, you know, because this stuff would really only come out very rarely as I got older, but still kind of like a child. I started to associate, you know, these bottles with kind of magical times, you know, when people came to visit, when the priest came to visit, or when my nan came, or when, you know, when relatives came, and to celebrate their presence in our house, the cabinet would be open and one of these bottles would be taken out, and it would, and this smell, I mean, the smell of gin, when I think about it, I still quite like the smell of gin, actually. It's got, you know, really extraordinary sort of flavor to it, and whiskey and all these different things. But then, you know, it would go back, and it was almost like, I mean, it was like magic, you know. And I remember, you know, I was probably six, seven when I got in there with a glass and I mixed a few things up and, you know, thought I'd try it. And like, that was one of the first really big mistakes of my life. And that was probably one of the first times, you know, I mean, I just, you know, I felt so ill and felt so bad. So, you know, I didn't know what that was. I just knew it wasn't for me. So I stayed away from that for a while. And I think the first time that I kind of met alcohol on its own terms and, you know, was again, you know, family tradition. Sundays we would have this, we would call it a roast in, and it would be like lamb, beef or chicken, ching, 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 week by week, you know, and we'd have this meal. And it was really the only time that my parents and I would actually sit and have this meal together. And my dad would mix this beer. He would use this brown ale, really sudsy, dark brown beer, and he would mix it with lemonade. And we called it a shandy in the UK, right? And he would mix this and he would give me one, right? And maybe I was 10 at this time, 10, 11, 12. And we'd like chink glasses and I'd have like, you know, he'd have a bigger one and I'd have a little one. And that felt good. It felt like, you know, but dad's recognizing that I'm a man, you know, and it felt like there was something about it. I mean, I'm not saying it had an extraordinary effect on me, but it was like a rite of passage thing, you know. Only children. I don't know if there's any only children in the audience on this call, but you know, I didn't love school, to be honest. I didn't love it, you know. I came from a home where I never had to fight for attention. You know, nobody criticized me if I got the answer wrong. You know, it was like a lot of love. And school was competitive, man. You know, and I realized that, like, you know, if you came to school and you came from a home where you were already like vibing with your siblings and there was a certain degree of competitiveness, then you were a little bit more primed for someone like me who was just used to having it all my own way. You know, and I get to school and it's like, and it's not all about me. And I realize I'm kind of shy and, you know, and as I got older, you know, I mean, I wasn't athletic. I wasn't into any of that. And I was kind of too shy to shine. You know, as I got into my teens, I just sort of pulled away from school. You guys call it playing hooky. I started playing hooky a lot, like day after day after day. And what filled that vacuum was this like burgeoning love for music that I had. I just started getting into music. I started getting into the music stars of the day. There was like Bowie and Queen and Rod Stewart, you know, and the Beatles, obviously. But I really start getting into music and I start spending most of my days like up in the town, hanging around the record stores, having a coffee, you know, having a piece of cake and then going back home, you know, and my parents think, oh, he's been at school all day. And I would do that over and over again. And, you know, I went to college for a year and when I was at college, I formed a band and, you know, I was quite lucky, you know, again, because of when I was born, like in the mid-70s in the UK, there was this musical movement called punk rock. And it's really, if you weren't there, it's really hard to, I mean, it was so huge. This thing was, it was huge for about a year. And for about a year, like every kid my age, like 15, 16, 17 year old, suddenly everybody wants to be in a band, you know, and you didn't have to play. You didn't really have to be able to play that much. You know, I had no musical training, but I just knew I loved music and I'd been going to see these artists, you know, on these big stages thinking, wow, you know, I'll never do that, you know, and suddenly there's this like street movement, you know, and it's just about attitude and what you're wearing and how you're doing your hair. And you really don't need to play that much. And I'm like, well, I don't need to play that much. And I just start playing with some of my mates from school. And I found my niche. I mean, we talk here about, we found our tribe, and definitely I found my tribe here. But when I was 16, and suddenly finding like kids that were just happy to make music out of like fucking tins, biscuit tins, you know, and one drum, you know, and like, I mean, it was basic shit, man. But, you know, it was great, great fun, and started writing songs and and they were terrible, but we just kept at it, and it was terrible, but we just loved it, and it was terrible, but you just kept doing it. And you know, a little bit the way I feel about AA, actually. I mean, I generally, when I do something in music, and I've been doing it a long time now, whether it's a song or a show, I'll think, yeah, it was good. Next time it's going to be better, though, you know, because I think it's just something that you're always working towards, some kind of, you know, you're like, we talk about progress, not perfection. You know, the chances you're not going to hit perfection, you know, you're just not. But you know what? You just keep making progress. And I got a record deal when I was really young. My band, we scored a deal. And suddenly I'm like, you know, I'm still living at my parents' house, and I'm going around the world, and I'm starting to tour. And this is where drugs and alcohol really enter into my story, because, you know, I'm essentially this like pretty shy kid and pretty low key. I've got this accent. If I spoke in the accent that I had back then, nobody would understand the word I was saying. You know, I was like this suburban kid from the Midlands of England. And I have to meet this moment in my life where suddenly, you know, we're on TV, we're on girls' walls, we're like fucking everywhere. And somebody introduces me to cocaine, and the cocaine and alcohol's already in there, but alcohol's just in there because, like, well, you know, I'm like 19 and 20 and people are drinking now. I mean, we're all drinking when we're 19, right? I mean, like, that's what you do. It's one of the things that makes a difference between a grown up and a kid, right? We drink, you know, a few times a week. Somebody puts this fucking, gives me a line of cocaine, and suddenly what I've been drinking, it's like push turbo power. And whatever it was I was drinking, and I like to think, I was like, you know, this is like 1981, right? So rum and coke, planter's punch, if anybody remembers that, screwdrivers, those kinds of things, really cheap champagne, actually not always cheap champagne, white wines, German white wines, those kinds of drinks, which you add a little toot to that, and suddenly, why, I tell you, I am like the man, right? And, you know, I've got a gig, you know, where really I go to work at 9 o'clock at night, right? And I've got to like preserve this energy. I've got to maintain my energy. And then 9 o'clock, out the traps, 2 hours of like hell for leather, full on energy. And then I come off, and then I want to have fun, right? Well, you know, really my body wants to go to bed. My body wants to say, John, can we call it a night now? And I'm like, hell no. the night is just starting, you know, and I realized that this cocaine and alcohol combo was just what I needed to really put a light a fire under 11 p.m., you know, and turn 11 p.m. rather than like the witching hour, the hour that everybody's going to bed, into that time of day where really the day gets started. And I have to say, you know, for about, well, no more than 2 years, but less than 2 years, but it fucking worked. And, you know, it's something, there's some things that we all stand together on, every one of us and on every one of us in this meeting tonight. I think, you know, there was a moment for us all when it worked. You know, if it hadn't worked, we wouldn't have gone on doing it for years and years and years. I couldn't believe how well it worked. I couldn't believe how much fun I had under the influence of drugs and alcohol. It was insane. And I would say for about 18 months, forget work. I mean, work just went out the window. But the time I had was incredible. And until it wasn't. And I suppose, you know, we often talk in AA, don't we, about like when we start drinking, when drinking really takes over, we almost, we pause, you know, we stop growing, you know, because really all we're doing is drinking and using. You know, and everything else, you know, and my band, the fact that I was in this band, you know, it's such a big part of my story. And the fact that you've got like this only child that essentially forms this partnership with these four guys who we're all the same age. We all come from the same socioeconomic background. You know, our parents got along really well. We all had the same sense of humor, and we're all moving through this career together, and really pretty kind of extraordinary ride that we all took together. But I noticed after a couple of years that a couple of them have gotten married and bought homes, and you know, they've gotten a couple of them got a dog, one of them got a cat, and they're paying the bills. And me, I'm just waking up thinking, have I got what I need for tonight? Have I got what I need for tonight? And, you know, because the drugs and the alcohol have become my primary purpose, you know, and what went from, you know, when I was 21, it was like this luxury. It was a luxury. I mean, the first time I came to America and some fucking record company guy rolled up $100 bill and said, here, toot the line off that. And I'm like, wow, this is success, you know? And I got frozen that. That was suddenly like the most, that was the most, you know? But my other guys were like, yeah, that's cool. But I mean, like, there's more to life than that, you know? Well, not for me, there wasn't. You know, that I got stuck on that. You know, I got stuck on that. And everybody else is just getting on. You know, they're just getting on. They're just progressing life on life's terms. I mean, life on life's terms is a phrase that we get introduced to in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like that's the kind of people we are. That idea has to be introduced to us because we have never done life on life's terms. You know, we've always looked for a side hustle, looked for a shortcut, looked for something, some way, some manipulation. So we don't have to do life on life's terms. I don't want to do life on life's terms. And when somebody gave me this alcohol drug combination, that was it. I was done with life. I just wanted to be under the influence of drugs and alcohol. You know, if I was awake, that's how I wanted it to be. Well, you know, like all of us here, it worked until it stopped working. And, you know, and people were starting to talk about me behind my back, and, you know, and the hangovers were getting, you know, were getting heavy, and I was having to cancel a lot of work. And, you know, that's the other thing. We get super good at manipulating. I mean, if you've got a dependency on anything, you know, you're going to become a manipulator, you know, because stage one, you realize you've got a dependency here. You've got a habit. You've got an addiction, even though I wouldn't have used those words at the time. But then you realize, two, you cannot let anybody know. So what do? We've got to start lying through our teeth. No, I can't come into work today. I've got this pain, or I've got this, or, you know, granny just came into town, or whatever it was. You know, we'd have to start telling these lies. And we start getting away with all of this stuff. I mean, I guess I got to about 25, 26, and I started thinking, you know what, maybe I need to look at this. You know, maybe, the kind of the career was sort of going off, you know, we kind of lost the honeymoon was over. We weren't really the hot thing anymore. And I started thinking, maybe I need to look at my drinking and using, you know, maybe I need to, you know, and I thought, well, maybe I'll just do it at the weekends. You know, it probably that period. And again, we've all had that period, right? We've all gone through that period. You don't get to AA without having a phase in your drinking where you think, maybe I'll just do it at the weekends, you know, and that seems like a good plan until you get to Thursday. Yeah, and then you get to Thursday and somebody offers you a drink and you go, well, actually, I wasn't going to, well, do you want a line? Yes, I'll have that, you know, or whatever it is. And I'm not terribly good with boundaries today, to be honest. You know, in fact, it's almost like if I want to do something, I have to tell myself, don't set yourself a boundary, because I'm just terrible at that. And every time I try to rein in my using some kind of, you know, look, just drink, just have a beer if you go out, just have a beer. And I have a beer, but then the beer would set, I didn't know it at the time, but it would just start this thing going, and I needed something stronger. And I'd have a fucking double vodka, and then the fucking vodka got something going, and then I'd need some drugs, and then who knows? And then thank God I'm still alive, because, you know, drugs and alcohol started to get me into a lot, take me to a lot of dark places, you know. And I tried some really desperate measures to get sober. I got married, you know. I thought that'll calm me down. It didn't. I thought, and then we had a child. I thought that would calm me down. It didn't. We moved to California. It didn't, nothing worked, nothing worked. And what's more, all of those big life changes that would affect any normal person just made me more and more made me think, I have got a fucking problem and I don't know how to do anything about this. Now, I don't know whether I would have said the problem was my drinking and using. I think at this point now, I'm just thinking I am a loser. You know, there's a, I don't know, you know, Monty Python's Flying Circus. I don't know whether we have anybody in the room that remembers Monty Python's Flying Circus. Yeah, they had a character called Dumby and he would go, "What is wrong with me? What is wrong?" And I was like that guy. I was like banging my head against the wall going, "What's the matter with me? Why can't I get on? Why can't I get on top of this thing?" And it's like everything else was going wrong in life. You know, my marriage was falling apart, you know. And so I start seeing a therapist I've moved to LA. I'm seeing a therapist there and seeing her several times a week. And we're talking about the marriage and why the marriage isn't this and isn't that. And I've got to go back to London to work. And I'm really nervous. I have to say I'm nervous because I know that I've got no control, you know, and I'm thinking I'm going to get on the plane and somebody's going to offer me a drink and then blah, blah. I mean, who knows what can happen? And I'm kind of terrified. And I said to the therapist, I said, "You need to find me somebody I can see when I go, you know, you need to find me somebody that I can speak to when I get there." I mean, that's how fragile my life was at that point. And, you know, and I'm lucky. And as I say that to you guys, you know, I realize I was privileged, you know, and I was privileged that I was actually able to say that to somebody, and I was able to get off the airplane at the other end and go and see somebody, you know. But I talked to this person for 10-15 minutes, and this guy said to me, "Look, I'm not the guy for you, but there is a woman you might want to talk to. She works out of the healing center in St. John's Wood. Her name is XXY. Why don't you give her a call?" And I called this lady, and she was an American lady, Lois Evans. She said to me, "Well, look, can you be here at 7 o'clock and I said, "Yeah," and I went to see her. This is still the day I've gotten off the plane. I spoke to her for about 20 minutes and she said, "You need to get into 3 12-step programs right now." She says, "You need to get sober. If you get sober, you could really be somebody. And if you get sober, maybe we can find out what it is that's going on with you." And I mean, that was the first time I'd heard those words, 3-step, 12-step programs. I think getting sober is probably the first time I'd heard that idea, you know. And, she suggested I go to rehab in America. This is where the best ones are. And so I didn't do it right away. Actually, I have to say I didn't do it right away. I just needed to have one more night, you know, one more just great night where I went out with no intention of drinking. But I did have one drink and, you know, and I ended up coming home at about 11 a.m., you know, with shit on my pants, no money in my pocket, you know. Just a fucking mess, you know, like, what the hell happened? Well, you know, that's how we like them in AA. That's how we like our newcomers. And I was plumped up and ready. And so I surrendered, you know, And I went to Arizona and I signed up for 30 days at Sierra Tucson. And I've got to say, again, I feel immensely privileged that I got to make that choice, you know, that I was able to make that choice, you know. I mean, yeah, I mean, this is my story, you know, and day one, I'm still wearing the scrubs because I'm detoxing, but I go to my first AA meeting, my first 12-step meeting, and it's a round robin meeting. And there's about 30 clients, I think they call them, or patients in the rehab. And the guy that was leading the meeting that day, it was his last day. He was about to leave the next day and he was feeling pretty good about himself. He said, "I'd like to hear about gratitude." I'm like, you know, what's gratitude? And people start to share, and I'm like, "Well, wait a minute, that's how I feel, and that's my experience." And, you know, and I'm having identification, right? What we call identification. And as the shares roll around, I'm thinking, wait a minute, you know, what's going on here? You know, I was convinced that my problems were unique, you know, that I was unique, that really there really could not be any kind of, you know, group antidote, you know, from what I had, because my story was so unique. But I'm hearing people are using language to describe how it has been for me, what it was like, you know, what it's like now. And, you know, and in that identification, that wall is broken down, you know, that wall is broken down, you know, and my eyes are, you know, watering, you know, and I'm softening and I'm, and, you know, is that, you know, optimism? Is that like a sense of, you know, something? Is that faith? You know, that's kind of like appearing in my mind. Do I, you know, I remember in that very first meeting, somebody said, we've been hauled out of the drink and we've been put in the lifeboat. And this is a lifeboat. And I'm like, wow, I get that. And, you know, and I had another, you know, and I had a 30-day introduction to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I mean, it was fucking radical. I mean, it was extraordinary. And, you know, I mean, I love this program. I love everything about it, you know, and I love how it's all about me, but it's all about us, you know, and I can, and if I want to make it all about me, I damn well can. But you know what? It's so much better when I make it all about us. And it's so much better when you and me get together and talk about how it's all about me or you, you know, and it's just that, I don't know. It's just this language that we use. And it's just, if you got it, 12 steps speaks to you, you know, if you've got it. And, you know, and I came out of that rehab on day 31 and I went back to Los Angeles. I went to my first open meeting of AA and it was at the Log Cabin. You know, if anybody's been to LA sober, they may well have been to the Log Cabin. I mean, it's just a classic, you know, it's just one of the great rooms. Thousands of people have gotten sober in that room. And I go to this place at 7:30 a.m. and I'm like, what the hell? the energy in that room. I mean, the energy of, like, you know, 100 sober men and women, you know, that are, many of whom are counting days. I thought, oh, I never need to go to a nightclub again. This is what I've been looking for my entire life. And I meet this guy. I was sort of on a blind date, actually, that my wife had set up with this other English musician that, like, was one of the great punk rockers, as it happens. And I'm like, what? He's alive? No, he's not just alive. He's sober and he's got time and he will meet you at this meeting. And so I go and I meet him and, like, you know, people are like giving it. People are like, hey, man, shaking hands. You know, there's respect and this guy's got integrity. And, you know, day 31, you know, we go to, I think we went to 3 meetings that day. You know, we went to this big old early morning meeting. Then we went to a noon or somewhere. And then we went to a men's meeting, stag meeting in the evening. I mean, that was fucking terrifying. I mean, I couldn't remember the last time. I mean, who wants to be in a room, alone in a room with 30 guys? Not me. And not then I didn't. You know, now I love it. You know, but then I was just terrified. But, you know, I made it to bed that night. You know, I made it to bed that night. And following morning, you know, I woke up like there was a fire in the house. I get in the car, I drive to the fucking log cabin at 7:30 in the morning. I make it through into the meeting. Oh my God. You know, I mean, it is. I mean, those early days, guys, it's like hand to mouth. You know, I tell people that are counting days, you just, all you've got, all you need to care about is meetings, meetings, meetings. You know, you need to do 3 meetings in a day, do 3 meetings in a day. There ain't no shame in it. All that matters is that you get through the day sober. You know, all that matters is that time. People say time don't matter. Of course it matters, because you're building character and you're building resilience. You're building resistance, because damn, that drink is going to come at you. Those drugs are going to come at you, and you need armor. We need to be armored. It is a shit show out there. I mean, there's more drugs alcohol out there today than ever in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So if we are going to live a life, you know, outside of Zoom, outside of our own homes, outside of meetings, man, we've got to be tough. We've got to be tough. We've got to be strong. And, you know, I'm one of the lucky ones. I love meetings. That is not what I just said. Not a problem for me. I love them. I've never left a meeting and thought that was a waste of time. I never have. I swear. I've never thought it was a waste of time. I call it money in the bank. Like, on the other hand, I'm the worst person. I've never saved a dime in my life. Give me a dollar, I spend it. I'm one of those guys. You know, I'm like, earn a dollar, spend two. I've never been good at saving money. But meetings, money in the bank, money in the bank. And, you know, the English dude, the punk rocker, you know, he's taking me around. He's taking me every day, this guy. I mean, every fucking day he is driving me around town and we're going to meetings. I mean, you know, and, you know, and after a few weeks, I asked him to be my sponsor. And he's, well, I already am. And we were, you know, we go through the steps. I mean, the sponsor relationship, I mean, it's one of the many gifts in this program. I'm not sure that there's any gifts that are greater than that, the sponsor relationship. I mean, as a guy that really struggled to be a man amongst men and really struggled to be a guy, like a guy's guy, you know, never really liked soccer, never really liked, you know, the kind of those obvious bonding things that guys have. I found my sponsor taught me all about that. You know, he has taught me how to be a man amongst men. And, you know, and he's completely the opposite to me. I mean, this guy doesn't like using words of more than one syllable. You know, he really doesn't. Everything is very, very fundamental to him. But that's how I need it. That's how I need it, because I can complicate anything. And, you know, I went back on the road eventually and, you know, and I learned that wherever rock and roll is served, Alcoholics Anonymous is there, you know, and I don't think I've been anywhere on tour, you know, in the 25 plus years that I've been sober, that there hasn't been an AA meeting. I mean, it's interesting because before I got sober, I'd go to a city like Tokyo, you know, and I'd be like, and I wanted to go to the clubs, you know, and I wanted to go to the clubs, and then I'd go to the boutiques. I'd get to know the vibe of the place, you know. Well, now I go to Tokyo and all I want to do is go to some fucking midday meeting, you know, in some church in like the back of beyond where there's like six people, you know, having a 60 minute meeting. You know, a couple of them are like English teachers and one brother. And I come out of that and I'm like, yeah, I'm set. I know this town. It's so weird how it works. You know, I love to share this particular anecdote because, you know, I am a touring musician. It's really what I do for a living. So for me, you know, a big part of my story is the fact that I get paid to travel the world and appear on stages anywhere that will have me. And, you know, and I was touring through Southern Asia. You know, and we're playing Singapore, travel, Taiwan, travel, Bangkok, you know, and we get to Jakarta and it's a really intense schedule and there's no time to get to meetings. I get a day off in Jakarta and I'm like, if I don't get to a meeting today, I'm going to kill somebody. I'm going to kill somebody in this band, you know, as somebody going down. Cause I'm so dry. And I think if my memory serves me, I think we were still on like paper meeting. You know, I had this world directory that I would take with me and it was about that big world directory. And I go like Asia, Indonesia, Jakarta. Fuck. You know, the meeting's like it's in 3 days time, but there was a phone number and I called the number and someone picked up and we start talking. And this other person is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we start talking about being sober. We talk, you know, sort of telling them how I'm feeling. 15 minutes, maximum 20 minutes. And then I think it was a lady. She says, look, if you like, I can come over to your hotel. We can have coffee. I said, you know what? I'm good. Thank you. Put the phone down. I thought, how does this work? I mean, in a city of 15 million, there's one other member of Alcoholics Anonymous in this city. And the fact that I now know that means I'm okay, that I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it through the day, through the night. Now, that to me is a miracle. I can't draw any kind of parallel with that in civilian life. That is extraordinary to me. Now, when I can acknowledge something like that, the power of that experience, acknowledging that, that's all the power that I need to believe that this shit is not only, it's going to get me through the day, it's going to get me through the night, you know, it's going to make me stronger and stronger and stronger. And then when I do have to take that leap, because we are all going to have to take that leap, at some point we're going to have to go somewhere, a funeral, a wedding, a vacation, family vacation. We're going to have to go somewhere where our sobriety is going to be tested. Not only can we escape that, we don't want to escape that. We want to live life on life's terms. I don't want to be, I was in a prison when I was, the last few years of my drinking, I was in jail. You know, I was terrified of the outside world. I don't want to go back to that. I want to eat the fucking world. I want to go where I want to go. I want to go everywhere and anywhere. You know, I want to go to the Appalachian Regional Roundup, I tell you, is where I want to go. But, you know, I mean, I just want to be able to go. I want to be able to do. I don't want my alcoholism, which I do feel, you know, is a, you know, I'm living with a handicap of sorts. I do believe that, you know, and it's like diabetes. I mean, I just got a diabetes diagnosis about 6 months ago, and it's like, you know, and it requires a little bit of, you know, like a reassessment, you know, and I have to, it's taking me a while, you know, and there's anger and there's fear and there's sadness, you know, there's all those feelings are coming up because I'm having to make these changes, but X-ing drugs and alcohol and knowing, you know, wherever it is I'm going to go, I'm going to do it without drugs and alcohol. That's a big thing. But I don't want to compromise, you know. I mean, however many years or months I've got left on this planet, you know, I don't want my choices to be determined by my alcoholism. You know, I don't want to be, you know, it's like, and you know, when I find myself doing that, if I'm dry, you know, if I've missed a couple of days of a meeting or, you know, I notice how my dryness starts determining. I start saying no, you know, and I start getting a little mean and snide and cynical. And I don't want to see the grandchild because, you know, it just starts growing over me. You know, I need to be really, it's like I always say, I want moist sobriety. I don't want to be dry, you know, you snap a dry twig. It's like, it's so easy. But a moist twig, that's like you really gotta pull at that thing, you know? And that's how I wanna be. And the way that I know how to be that is by doing this and showing up to these rooms, you know, day in, day out, three meetings a day, if that's what it's gotta be, you know. I mean, online, man, I mean, hats off to all of us, right? How has AA handled the pandemic? Like, I mean, better than any other agency I'm aware of. You know, if ever we needed like reinforcement that we know what we're doing, you know, because it's life or death for us, plain and simple, right? You know, it's like, you know, they're closing down the meeting rooms. What do? I mean, we went online so fast, so fast, like our lives depended on it, you know, and now look at us. How extraordinary is it? I mean, for me, believe me, to have this experience of talking to you all tonight, it is beyond my wildest dreams. It's extraordinary and amazing. And I'm so grateful to you all for letting me have it. But you know, meetings, IRL meetings are coming back. Bricks and mortar meetings are coming back. We can have it both ways now, you know, to the degree that that we choose. You know, we started a meeting, you know, Moorpark, it's a 9 a.m. PST meeting, you know, and we went from like 25 people 5 days a week, you know, at a room in Studio City to like 150, going up 175 people online every day of the week, you know. And we formed an offshoot men's meeting. And I mean, man, it's amazing, amazing, amazing. And, you know, in those early days of the pandemic, when people were coming in counting days, and those of us with time were thinking, oh my God, they're never going to get, how are they going to stay sober without real meetings? And they did. They did, you know, and now we're getting people that are celebrating, you know, like a year, they're coming on 2 years, and some of them have hardly been to a real meeting, you know, and their sobriety is just as strong. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. And, you know, I hope if any of you, you know, I mean, you know, enthusiasm. I mean, I hope you picked up on my enthusiasm for the program, you know. You know, I don't consider this a prison sentence. I love it. I love it. I get the connection with humanity that I always longed for, you know. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I find it's like, I mean, my relationship with humanity is complicated. You know, I'm sure it is for all of us here. You know, it's like we're so full of love, but we so often don't know how to share it. You know, we're complicated people, you know, and AA at least provides some degree of simplicity, some way of just, you know, on a daily basis, just like, you know, how to get along and live life on life's terms. And, you know, this is it. You know, we had to go, we had to get down so low, you know, to get the golden ticket. And I consider I have that. And thanks for letting me share tonight.